The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Beautiful day here at Edstone. Some big snowflakes. We're right in the midst of, I think the beginning stages of what's supposed to be a pretty big snowstorm coming in, as the newsman said the other night, from Russia. That's still always a surprise when I hear that, for me to realize just how close we actually live to Russia. We've got the British weather system today colluding with Russia. And all of this snow dropping here in the Midlands. We've also got our college campout coming up on Thursday. So hopefully it won't be too treacherous out on the roads, as we have, I think, a 3 or 4 hour trip up north into the Lake District this year. So that'll be exciting. And that's coming up, as I say, just in a couple of days. Well, I thought I would start today's news gathering and study. We'll look into some, some pretty exciting scriptures as we proceed. But to set it up, to just refer you again, hopefully I'm not coming across too repetitive with the shooting in Parkland, Florida. But as I mentioned yesterday, this really was a breakdown from top to bottom. You see, just a failure from the FBI on down, all of the red flags that were missed. And I mentioned, I think briefly, even the school district that had come up with this program, I think back in 2013, the Broward County Public Schools superintendent, it's a man by the name of Robert Runcie. He's a black administrator who was really concerned about the disproportionate penalties that went out around the school district, whether in the form of suspensions or even arrests. And so basically the school came up with a program that just did away with some of this, some of the penalties altogether. This was covered, in fact, back in 2013 at the American Prospect. Just to give you a little bit of background, and what I want to try to do here is to just get across the mentality that these law enforcement agencies, or the public school district, just the mentality and how that they dealt with troubled individuals. The American Prospect says, like most large school districts in the U.S., discipline policies in Broward reflected the idea that the best way to maintain an orderly classroom is to get rid of disruptive students, an approach known as zero tolerance. It says zero tolerance policies help explain why 81% of all suspensions in New York City schools in 2012 and 13 were for minor infractions, and 70% of all arrests were for misdemeanors. It explains why 67% of all school-based arrests in Florida in 2011 and 12 were for misdemeanors. So then it goes on to explain some of the changes that this superintendent put in place in Broward County. It continues here. Broward announced broad changes designed to mitigate the use of harsh punishments for minor misbehavior at the beginning of this school year. While that's speaking of the school year that was in 2013, so this was a few years ago. While other districts have amended their discipline codes, prohibited arrests in some circumstances, and developed alternatives to suspension, Broward was able to do all of these at once with the cooperation of a group that included a member of the local NAACP, a school board member, a public defender, a local sheriff, a state prosecutor, and several others. So in other words, some of these districts in and around that area, all across the United States, I mean, they put in some of these more lenient policies, but in Broward, they were able to bring them all together because everybody was on board with it. The sheriff, the superintendent, the NAACP, the public defender, everyone. It says, in early November, the Miami Herald reported that suspensions were already down 40% and arrests were down 66%. This is in 2013. It says, yet these changes required years of advocacy. They came from the left wing, politically. This was something, remember, that President Obama and Eric Holder were out there championing all through the Obama years. And on this program, there toward the end of his presidency, you'll remember we talked about the many times, particularly in the last couple of years, all these grants of clemency, the commutations. We gave a stat 2 years ago how that George W. Bush commuted 11 prison sentences over the course of his 8 years in office. And I don't remember what the final tally was for Barack Obama, but in that last year, he was into the hundreds. He was pushing up over 300 people at 92 life sentences President Obama commuted. So these were not just all mild infractions. We played a clip on this program, in fact. I didn't bring it with me this time, but from March of 2016, President Obama, he said, I'm going to continue to emphasize the importance of pardons and commutations going forward. Today we commuted 61 additional individuals who are deserving and who I believe will be looking at the people sitting here at this table as models and inspiration for what is possible in their lives. And then he said later on, we're not done. We're going to keep on working on this until I leave. In July of 2016, you might remember that President Obama became the first U.S. president to visit a federal prison. That happened as it happens in Oklahoma, El Reno, the El Reno Federal Correctional Institution. And he, during this brief Q&A for his visit there in El Reno, he said that he was struck by the fact that these inmates are young people who made mistakes that aren't different. They're not much different than the mistakes I made, the president said. I mean, they're basically just like me. Before he actually arrived in Oklahoma, he told the NAACP in Philadelphia, he said, while the people in our prisons have made some mistakes, and sometimes big mistakes, they are also Americans. So they deserve a second and third chance. We need to keep in mind they're Americans and they need opportunities. Which, you know, if someone's truly repentant, it's not like anyone would be against someone having a second or a third opportunity. But you can see how this would get out of hand in a hurry. And it did. It did get out of hand. Going back to this American Prospect piece, it says Broward's collaborative agreement on school discipline was announced in early November 2013. Instead of suspensions, students can now be referred to the Promise Program. So they weren't suspended. They were referred instead to the Promise Program, where they receive counseling for several days and then they return to school. It says a host of nonviolent misdemeanors no longer require an arrest, though officers can sometimes override that if they feel it is necessary. I want to make sure deputies always have discretion, says Scott Israel, Broward County Sheriff. He's quoted in that 2013 article, Sheriff Israel. It says later, the school district's Office of Minority Male Achievement reviews data to ensure that punishments for minor infractions and racial disparities are on the decline. So they were looking at the numbers overall, and all infractions or punishments for them were in decline, and then the racial disparity also, as they were bringing that back down to, I guess, certain percentages that they were aiming for. It says Broward is unusual because representatives from law enforcement, the district, and the community were able to agree on reform, and the superintendent approved it. So as I say, it was unusual because everyone, all of the leadership in the district, was on board with making these kinds of changes that the president wanted to see happen all across the nation, President Obama. Now, you go again to this most recent shooting, and you look at all of the missed red flags, all of the minor infractions that weren't punished. Or in the case of one deputy, the one that wouldn't go in and confront the shooter, it wasn't even filed. A police report wasn't even drawn up for a more minor infraction, going back to, I think, last November. And then, of course, the sheriff himself, you wonder, as this story continues to unfold, just how much his leadership had to do with not just one deputy refusing to go inside the school, but three others, evidently, that showed up and also took a position behind their vehicles. This Sheriff Israel, remember, I think I mentioned this on the program either yesterday or last week, but he, after the Vegas shooting in, October of last year, he told a local reporter that, well, there's really nothing that you can do. We'll come to that. I think I have that clip. We'll play that in just a little bit. Let me first take you to something that Sheriff Israel said back in 2015. This is clip two, Sam, if you want to cue it up. But I just read you the article about the new policies that the superintendent put in place back in 2013. And this is Sheriff Israel speaking at a Florida mosque in 2015, where he's talking about some of these same policies. And as you can hear, I mean, he's quite proud of them. The fact that they were keeping people out of jail. And that, as he says, is really what shows how successful these policies, how successful they were. Here he is at a Florida mosque in 2015, clip two.
To be here during Ramadan is an honor to me. It's an absolute honor. I've never spoken to, at a mosque during the month of Ramadan. This is an absolute honor, and I'll never forget that. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity. Nazar is right. I have said over and over and over again, we have to measure the success of the Broward Sheriff's Office by the kids we keep out of jail, not the kids we put in jail. We have to take care of our children. We have to give our children second chances and third chances. That's why we have a civil citation program. So when children commit misdemeanors, not violent, instead of going to jail, we put them in a program so they get help with narcotics, with anger management, with alcohol, mental health issues, because the idea is to keep them out of jail from ever going back. And that's what we work real hard with.
That's what the Broward County had been working really hard doing for the past 4 years or so, keeping young people out of jail and putting them instead into a program where they could get help with their narcotics addictions or with anger management or with mental health issues even. That's the PROMISE program, to use the language that the superintendent used back in that 2013 article. Now, when you think about then the deputy that was there on the campus that didn't go inside and confront the shooter, and then three more from Broward County that showed up, and then all the reports that Coral County, when their officers showed up, they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that they weren't confronting the shooter. What was going on? There was a report, I think even last night, I believe this was on Laura Ingraham's show on Fox News, that said that the Broward County deputies were told not to go into that Douglas High School facility, that they may have been given an order not to go in. In other words, this was perhaps part of their training. This is how you handled a mass shooting, let it play out, I suppose. And again, when you think about another statement that Sheriff Israel made, this is from last October. This is the one following the Vegas mass shooting. But listen to what he said about what you do if you have this lone wolf assassin. Here's clip three.
If you have a lone wolf assassin that's committed to commit great carnage and kill people, there's really not anything you can do about it.
That's something he said on a local news affiliate back in October. And some are wondering if this is the mindset that maybe helps to explain why as many as four deputies failed to engage the shooter. Well, there's nothing really that you can do about it. You can't really confront that kind of evil. You just let it play out. Now, there's been some discussion back and forth. Even the president weighed in yesterday on the lack of courage here. And I would imagine the breakdown from top to bottom has a lot of Americans thinking or wondering, you know, well, what would I do? What would I do if I had a weapon? Or what would I do if I didn't have a weapon? I mentioned to you last week the example of the assistant football coach and another teacher who were seen sprinting into the facility, the freshman building, just to put themselves forward as a shield to save the lives of some of these teens. The president himself yesterday, he weighed in on the breakdown in leadership and even expressed in his view what he felt like he would have done had he been there. Here's President Trump, clip one.
But we have to take steps to harden our schools so that they're less vulnerable to attack. This includes allowing well-trained and certified school personnel to carry concealed firearm. At some point, you need volume. Now, I don't know that a school is going to be able to hire 100 security guards that are armed. Plus, you know, I got to watch some deputy sheriffs performing this weekend. They weren't exactly Medal of Honor winners. All right. The way they performed was, frankly, disgusting. They were listening to what was going on. The one in particular, he was early. Then you had three others that probably a similar deal a little bit later, but a similar kind of a thing. You know, I really believe you don't know until you test it. But I think I really believe I'd run in there even if I didn't have a weapon. And I think most of the people in this room would have done that, too, because I know most of you. But the way they performed was really a disgrace.
That was President Trump yesterday, and of course his enemies in the media really had a lot of fun at his expense over that statement about him saying he would have gone in after the shooter, pointing out that, well, where were you at Vietnam and all these other things. But, I mean, suffice it to say, we've all witnessed an appalling lack of courage from top to bottom. We've seen a breakdown in law enforcement. We've seen how these policies of lenience, they come back to explode in your face. All it takes is one time. Now, you put this on a much bigger level, as my father's talked about before. I mean, you look at nations warring against nations like Jesus prophesied, and then all the nuclear weapons, all the mass, the mass killing weapons that are all over this earth. And as my father has said, I mean, if you're wrong about it once, that's it. That's it. It's nuclear war. And look at the policies of appeasement and lenience that we've seen over the course of many years now at the highest levels of government. Carolyn Glick had an excellent piece yesterday just about what she feels like America could learn from Israel. And some commentators in the U.S. have pointed to Israel and how they've dealt with mass shootings. And she points out how that, you know, this is not uncommon to have a mass shooting take place where the policeman that's nearest the incident fails to act or to step forward. She refers to this incident in 2008, this shooting at a at a seminary in Jerusalem. This guy coming in with an assault rifle, this terrorist, he hid the rifle in a box and then got into this yeshiva and pulled out the rifle and started shooting away. And as Carolyn Glick brings out in her article, two beat cops arrived on the scene but failed to enter the building to stop the killing. In the event, a seminary student armed with a handgun and an off-duty infantry officer who lived in the neighborhood heard the shots and ran to the seminary. The student, a young rabbi, was armed with a handgun. The officer was carrying his assault rifle. Both men ignored the police officers, who told them not to go inside. They entered the building and killed the terrorist, ending the massacre. It says by the time they arrived, eight students, including five high school students, had been killed, while eight more were wounded. This happened back in March of 2008. And Glick then goes on to cite a number of other attacks over the years that have been thwarted by an armed citizenry. She's talked about Israel responding to some of these mass shootings by actually loosening their gun laws so that more citizens could get their hands on guns. She says most people have this misconception that Israel's just got, you know, wide open restrictions, or no restrictions, I mean. But they're actually quite strict in Israel, more strict even than America's gun laws. But she mentions in this piece how that some of those restrictions were removed so that more civilians could get guns. Now, most people that are touring through Israel think there's guns all over the place because they see soldiers that are carrying their rifles with them everywhere that they go. They have to. They can't leave it at their. Most of them don't have a safe that you can lock it in. A safe big enough to store a rifle. So if they can't lock it down, they have to carry it with them everywhere. And of course, it's such a tiny country. You've got these soldiers moving out and about, and so many of them carrying their rifles over their backs. In any event, getting back to Israel's gun laws and Carolyn Glick's piece here, she says, whereas private ownership of firearms is constrained, public use of firearms is more widespread. She says, every school in Israel is guarded by an armed security guard. Everyone entering a school has to pass through a manned, secure entrance. And so that's one thing that you see at, well, what would be a lot of soft targets in the United States. There's a lot better security in Israel, whether it's for schools or restaurants or stores, the mall, the bus station. And they do control the entrances and the exits. And there's usually just one or two of them. There's not like eight or ten. So that the armed guards can look at everyone coming in and out. And then there's metal detectors and so on. And of course, the cost for this in a country like the United States with more than 300 million people. I mean, when they first started talking about, look, we need more security guards on campuses at schools. My first thought was, boy, you talk about another trillion-dollar burden. And I think that's why the president and some others have talked about, well, what about if some of the teachers themselves are carrying concealed weapons? Teachers that maybe are members of the NRA or have taken courses in firearms. In any event, again, Carolyn Glick's just pointing out the differences here. She says the massacre outside the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas last year would also have been more difficult, if not impossible, to be carried out in Israel. A security officer at the entrance to the hotel would have stopped the shooter from bringing his weapons and ammunition into the building. There was no such security with the Mandalay Bay Hotel. It says if the killer had managed to smuggle his weapons into the hotel and had begun shooting, it would have taken hotel security officers very little time to identify the source of the fire, enter his room, and stop him. So she mentions a few examples, a few other ones that I won't take the time to go through. I just want to bring it to her conclusion. These are the recommendations that she makes. Despite the vast differences regarding the private ownership of weapons, there are two lessons from Israel's experience that may be significant for America. She says the first lesson that Israel can offer relates to tactics for minimizing the risk of attack. Americans can learn from the Israeli model of controlling entry and exit points from schools and other public facilities, from Israel's ban on guns to the mentally ill, and from its unapologetic policy of profiling terror suspects. Some of those suggestions there, you know, are not going to fly in the United States, but maybe controlling the entry and exit points better, like they would, let's say, with the Capitol in D.C. or the White House and or airports, banning guns on the mentally ill. But as many have even asked, following this suggestion here in the States or over in the States, where do you draw the line? What type of mental illness? And then here's her conclusion, a second lesson, she says. A second lesson from Israel's experience that bravery is a vital social virtue. Here's a second lesson, she says. Like millions of Americans, Israelis are brave. Because they are brave, they stand up to terrorists. When they have guns, they stand up to terrorists with guns. When they lack guns, they stand up to terrorists with whatever they have. She says, in February 2017, a group of citizens outside a sewing machine repair shop in Petah Tikva in central Israel stopped a terrorist who had been shooting and stabbing bus passengers by throwing sewing machines at him. She says, in January 2016, a mom-and-pop grocery store owner in a small town in Judea blocked two knife-wielding terrorists from entering his store by pushing them out with a shopping cart. And then she says this, a society that values bravery can rely on its citizens to be brave more easily than a society that values victimhood. She brings up a good point, an excellent point, about just the dearth of bravery and courage. That's, and of course, there's more of that in Israel probably than she even realizes. But you look at our nations, there are exceptions. Obviously, like even the president said, I mean, no one really knows until they're actually put in that position. But I think it's safe to say that the courage and the bravery, just on a mass scale, it's not there like it was a few generations ago. A society that values bravery can rely on its citizens to be brave more easily than a society that values victimhood. She says Israel's tragic history with terror attacks has required Israel to learn how to secure all public spaces and deploy forces to major civilian thoroughfares, and it has also taught Israelis to be brave. It's taught Israelis to be brave. There's so many enemies in Israel's neighborhood. They have to be constantly vigilant. And when there's a strike, when there's an attack, as she brings out, it's not always the case, like those two police officers she mentions from that 2008 incident. But there typically are enough Israelis close by to act, and to act courageously, and to act quickly. Now, as I was bringing out in another message here recently, what a valuable spiritual lesson there is for us in our fight against sin, in our fight against weaknesses, to just step up and to attack the problem, to go after the problem, spiritually speaking. I mean, we have to go through training and preparations for that, just like a security guard or a soldier in the army. We're in the midst of that training even now. And the Bible over and again points us to examples of courage, fearless courage, and of course faith in God. That's what's called for. during a time of crisis. We'll look at that a little bit more closely coming up in the next segment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Well, and looking at the clock, I'm not even sure how much time I'll have for the scriptures I wanted to get into, because I wanted to just go through the example of Churchill here, yet again. Churchill's courageous leadership. Who better to look to than Winston Churchill? For someone that, while he may not have looked like this big, powerful, menacing opponent, physically speaking, he was a man of incredible courage. Now, I referred last week, we went through this Spectator piece about the Darkest Hour movie, and how that, for the most part, it gets a lot of things right, except for that bit at the end where it basically credits the British people with inspiring Churchill to courageously fight on against Hitler, when in fact it was just the opposite. It was Winston Churchill who single-handedly inspired a fighting spirit in Britain, like that Spectator piece brings out. I mean, if it was left to the people, or even the leadership, leaving aside Churchill, if it was left to Britain in 1940, May of 1940, well, they probably would have made some kind of a deal with Hitler. But you leave that one flaw aside, there's still, again, I haven't seen the movie yet, but there still is a lot to take away from it, just judging by the many articles I've read about it. Victor Davis Hanson had a piece a number of weeks ago that we never did take the time to go through. But in this review of the movie, he talks about, you know, what Churchill was stepping into following the leadership of his predecessor, Neville Chamberlain, and all of his appeasement of Adolf Hitler, and just the disastrous first 9 months of World War II, where it seemed as if Britain had pretty much lost. Hansen says that Churchill was asked to become prime minister on the very day that Hitler invaded France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. He says the armies of all three democracies, together larger than Germany's invading forces, collapsed within days or a few weeks. France, going in, had the most powerful army in the world. These three together, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands,
They had forces that were stronger or at least larger than Germany's. And yet they collapsed within days. What happened? How could that happen? Well, then you have all the British troops, hundreds of thousands of them trapped at Dunkirk. And this is what Churchill was stepping into. Dark days indeed. Hansen says here, Churchill's greatest problem was not just saving the British army, speaking of those in Dunkirk, but confronting the reality that the German conquest of Europe, that with the German conquest of Europe, the British Empire had no allies. The Soviet Union had all but joined Hitler's Germany under their infamous non-aggression pact in August 1939, and the United States was determined at all costs to remain neutral. So Britain didn't have any allies. France was defeated. It says, within days of Churchill taking office, all of what is now the European Union either would be in Hitler's hands or could be considered pro-Nazi neutral. Darkest Hour gets its title from the understandable depression that had spread throughout the British government. Members of Churchill's new war cabinet wanted to sue for peace. Chamberlain and senior conservative politician Edward Wood both considered Churchill unhinged for believing Britain could survive. Both appeasers dreamed that thuggish Italian dictator Benito Mussolini might be persuaded to beg Hitler to call off his planned invasion of Great Britain. They dreamed Mussolini could save a shred of English dignity through an arranged British surrender. Well, then Hansen talks about the flaws in an otherwise superb film, and he brings up that fiction about Churchill riding on the tube and then receiving inspiration from the common Londoners. And then Hansen comes back to it saying, alone Churchill saw a pathway to victory against overwhelming odds. It says, as the film notes, Hitler may have had the world's greatest army in the spring of 1940, but he still had no way of transporting it across the British moat of the English Channel, given overwhelming British naval mastery. Churchill assumed that if Britain and its overseas empire could hold out, then a frustrated Hitler might turn elsewhere and thereby gain new enemies and new British allies. And that's exactly what happened in 1941. A blundering and frustrated Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. Later, he would declare war on the United States. By December 1941, Germany was at war against the world's largest economy, American, largest navy, British, and largest army, Soviet, all at once. And so the tide finally began to turn. But from May of 1940 all the way through to December of 1941, I mean, those were dark days. That's when Britain, or Winston Churchill to be more precise, stood completely alone with no allies. This little island nation hanging by a thread, hanging on the courageous leadership of one man. Hansen says here, actor Gary Oldman reminds a generation of amnesiac global youth that nearly 80 years ago, the dogged defiance of a 66-year-old Victorian Englishman, portly and not much over 5'6", saved Western civilization from Nazi barbarism. 5'6", 220-pounder, maybe not quite that much, over 200 pounds, 66 years of age. Hansen says here, Americans should watch Darkest Hour for reasons beside its engaging acting and plot. We rightly believe that American industry and Soviet manpower won World War II, yet too often, listen to this, too often Americans forget the critical third Allied ingredient, British leadership, courage, and military professionalism. Yes, the Soviet manpower was indispensable, as was American industry. But don't forget about those 18 months or so, those dark days when Britain stood alone, when Britain had nothing to stand on except for courage. A time when everyone, even in Britain, wanted to surrender, except for one man. What a lesson. What a lesson for us. Hansen says, Churchill led the only major nation to have fought Hitler alone. Only Britain fought from the first day to the last of World War II. It alone entered the war without attacking a country or being attacked, but simply on the principle of helping an independent Poland. The world as we know it today owes its second chance to Winston Churchill and the United Kingdom. Without them, civilization would have been lost in the darkest hours of May 1940. Those were dark hours for Britain and for all the West. And Churchill came into this impossible position on May 10th, 1940, and tried to bring together a coalition of rivals, including the ones that wanted to surrender, like Chamberlain and Halifax. Halifax was the one that suggested that Mussolini could serve as some kind of a mediator. Mussolini! But it was Churchill. It was Churchill who put his foot down. It was Churchill who first rallied the cabinet and then the entire nation. Before the cabinet, you'll remember, I mentioned this, I think, a few weeks back. Churchill talking about those days that he considered the requests of many, that he enter into negotiations with that man, as he called him. He says, I am convinced that every one of you would rise up and tear me down from my place if I were for one moment to contemplate parley or surrender. And then he said this, one of his best known quotes, if this Long Island story of ours is to end at last, let it end only when each one of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground. And after he made that statement, the room of, I think it was 20 or 25 people, erupted in cheers, in applause. Just a few days after that speech, or right around the same time, Churchill delivered his solemn hour speech before the nation. This is from May 19th, 1940, and I've got about a three-minute clip from that speech for you to hear. Here's clip four.
Our task is not only to win the battle, but to win the war. After this battle in France abates its force, there will come the battle for our island. For all that Britain is and all that Britain means, that will be the struggle. In that supreme emergency, we shall not hesitate to take every step, even the most drastic, to call forth from our people the last ounce and the last inch of effort of which they are capable. The interests of property, the hours of labor, are nothing compared to the struggle for life and honor, for right to freedom, to which we have bowed ourselves. I have received from the chiefs of the French Republic, and in particular from its indomitable Prime Minister, Monsieur Reynaud, the most sacred pledges that whatever happens, they will fight to the end, be it bitter nor be it glorious. Nay, if we fight to the end, it can only be glorious. Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed an administration of men and women of every party and of almost every point of view. We have differed and quarreled in the past, but now one bond unites us all: to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be. If this is one of the most awe-striking periods in the long history of France and Britain, it is also, beyond doubt, the most sublime. Side by side, unaided except by their kith and kin in the great dominions and by the wide empires which rest beneath their shield, side by side, the British and French peoples have advanced to rescue not only Europe, but mankind from the foulest and most soul-destroying tyranny which has ever darkened and stained the pages of history. Behind them, behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races: the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer. As conquer we must, as conquer we shall.
That's Winston Churchill from May of 1940. The mindset and the spirit, the courage in those words. And of course, he backed it up with action. This glorious fight, as he called it, we're going to rescue mankind from the stain of soul-destroying tyranny. 66 years old, 5'6", a little bit portly, but what a spirit. In my father's Royal Vision article, this is just from December 2017, his piece about Churchill and the examples that we can take away from this history, 7 keys for building leadership. And the seventh and final key that he discusses in that article is that a leader must have courage. A leader for God, any leader, he has to have courage. It says in the article, this is from Royal Vision, Churchill had to endure a lot of difficulty when he went off to those wars, but that military experience helped to build a lot of courage in him. And then my father talks about his willingness to stand up to Hitler, how he got the troops out of Dunkirk, the attitude that he had, that whether we live or die, we're going to go down fighting. I just gave you the quote. My father says this: we must have courage. There are things in our personal lives that we may fear, just as I'm sure Churchill feared some of the challenges he faced. But we can have the power of God behind us every time we try to carry out our duty. God will back us up. He goes on to say, if we step out in faith, God will back us up with power and really build our courage. But what an inspiration to even look into some of our own history books. I was reading some the other day just about George Washington when he was trying to push the British out of Boston back in 1775 and 1776, and he was writing to some of his close confidants about just how hopeless the situation was. If only the British knew how dire our situation is. Well, they'd come out and squash us right away. And yet, in front of all the troops, leaving aside his secret correspondence, he was a man of courage. He was a man who acted with bravery. Bringing it back to the spiritual lesson here, my father ties in 1 Corinthians 10:13 and how that God's not going to put us through more than what we can bear. But he will try and test us to encourage us to look to him, to cry out to him, to trust him. This article says, Churchill's fighting spirit made him unique among other men. That is the spirit that God wants us to have. We're going to fight to the death or to life, whatever God gives us. And using that example again from World War II, everyone wanted to give up, but it was Churchill's absolute refusal to do that. He would not compromise. In this article, my father quotes this historian, Cook, I forget his first name, but it says in his book, rather, an old English friend who served in the British embassies both in Washington and Moscow was always put off by Churchill's brutality, as he saw it, his contempt for the lesser breeds without the law, his lust for war, and so on. Nevertheless, he thought of him as a hero because, quote, I think he saved our lives. I think he saved our lives. Here's someone who had nothing but contempt for Churchill and his leadership. And yet even he had to acknowledge that Churchill saved us. He saved us. He saved the Western world. He stopped the West from being enslaved by Hitler and the Nazis. English author, this is from my father's piece, Harold Begbie. He wrote, but politics for Churchill have nothing to do with Churchill. It must have everything to do with the salvation of mankind. And then my father says, Churchill knew an unchecked Hitler meant the annihilation of the world. He was concerned about the salvation of mankind. And then to bring this lesson right up to today, with where we are today in prophecy, my father says, Churchill saved Britain when it was asleep. Now the world is in a coma, and God needs us to step up to our leadership potential. God needs his people to be people of courage. We're the leaders of tomorrow. I don't have time to go through all the scriptures on that. Kings and priests. A leader must have courage, as he says there at the end of that article on seven keys to building godly leadership. We can draw a lot of inspiration from these examples, even in secular history books, and even more from the Holy Bible, where there's just one example after another example after another example of courageous leadership, of these great courageous warriors for God. Read the last chapter of the Overcomer booklet on offensive warfare. I've got some more material on that subject that maybe I can get into tomorrow. But how important is courage? Well, in Malachi's message, my father brings out that all these other great character virtues, they're of little value if you don't have courage. And for this reason, he says, courage may be our greatest need. Churchill himself said, courage is rightly esteemed the first of human qualities because it is the quality which guarantees all the others. What good are the other qualities if you don't have the courage to act on your principles? To step up and to act. To do what's right. To confront evil. It's just too easy, isn't it? We see so many examples of it in our nations today, as I've gone over the past couple of weeks, of human beings cowering in fear when they should be stepping up courageously to act. Well, it's easier said than done. And none of us know exactly how we're going to act at that moment of crisis, which is all the more reason why we need God's Word and we need booklets like the Overcomer booklet and even history like Manchester's series on Churchill or what so many others have written about George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or just go right down the line. Courage is rightly esteemed the first of human qualities because it's the quality which guarantees all others. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.